Jefferson's presence in Paris was a godsend. The Virginian seemed entirely his old self, in ability and in his devotion to their common tasks as commissioners. "Jefferson is an excellent hand. You could not have sent a better," Adams wrote in December to Elbridge Gerry. The spirit of his observations markedly different from what Jefferson had written privately of him. "He appears to me to be infected with no party passions or national prejudices or any partialities but for his own country. Since our meeting upon our new commissions, our affairs have gone on with utmost harmony, and nothing has happened to disturb our peace. I wish this calm will continue, and believe it will." In a letter to Henry Knox, Adams wrote proudly, "You can scarcely have heard a characterization too high of my friend and colleague Mr. Jefferson, either in point of power or virtues. I only fear that his unquenchable thirst for knowledge may injure his health." That Jefferson was often ill during their time with him in France was of great concern to the Adamses, though Jefferson himself gamely dismissed it as no more than the seasoning required of all newly arrived strangers to the country. But privately, Jefferson, now 41, told Abigail he did not expect to live more than a dozen years longer. When feeling fit, which was much of the time, he was out and about, and as before in Philadelphia, proved an irrepressible shopper. At first chance, he bought a new dress sword, silver forks and spoons, candlesticks, wine, violin strings, the model of a hydraulic engine, every purchase recorded in his tidy accounts. He bought new French clothes for himself, French lace cuffs, French shirts and lace ruffles, French gloves, new clothes for Patsy, new clothes for James Hemings, whom he put on regular wages. The young man had been Jefferson's personal servant from the time Jefferson was governor of Virginia. He was 19 years old, the son of a slave named Betty Hemings, who had belonged previously to Jefferson's late father-in-law, John Wales, who reportedly was James's father, which, if true, meant that James was Jefferson's own half-brother-in-law. Since slavery was forbidden in France, James was to be quietly considered a free man for the time being. He would be apprenticed to one of the finest chefs in Paris, that he might one day bring the haute cuisine of France home to Monticello. Jefferson was still in arrears. The income from his operations at Monticello and his other farms failed to cover his debts, and, like the Adamses, he fretted that his salary was insufficient for the manner in which he was expected to live, and to which, unlike the Adamses, he was long accustomed. In matters of economy, as in other aspects of his life, Jefferson did not practice what he preached. He would insist to his daughter Patsy that she keep to the rule of never buying anything which you have not the money in your pocket to pay for, and warned that pain to the mind of debt was greater by far than having to do without any article whatever which we may seem to want. Yet this was hardly how he lived. A chronic acquirer, Jefferson is not known to have ever denied himself anything he wished in the way of material possessions or comforts. Once settled in Paris, he never held back, spending, for example, more than 200 francs for an initial stock of 59 bottles of Bordeaux, 200 francs being the equivalent of 3 months' wages for the average French worker. The rented house on the cul-de-sac Taboo was smaller than he liked and would not long satisfy, as he already foresaw. All the same, he proceeded to remodel two rooms and spent half his salary buying more and finer furniture than needed. He rented a pianoforte, hired 6 additional servants. A chariot, he fancied, wound up costing 15,000 francs by the time repairs were made, and it had been fitted out as he wished with green Morocco leather. With the United States behind on payments on its loans, Jefferson found Paris bankers reluctant to advance him sufficient sums to cover his expenses. In distress, he turned to Adams, who arranged a loan with banks in Amsterdam, as Adams had on occasion for his own expenses. Later, unable to repay the advance, Jefferson would turn to private creditors and go still deeper in debt. Like Adams, Jefferson wrote repeatedly to friends at home and in Congress, urging that the commissioners' salaries be raised to a realistic level. That the Adamses were able to make ends meet as they did, Jefferson attributed to what he regarded as an extremely plain style of life, and even more to Abigail's management of expenses. As Jefferson would explain in a letter to George Washington, John Adams had the advantage of being under the direction of Mrs. Adams, one of the most estimable characters on earth, and the most attentive and honorable economists. Yet, at no point did Jefferson's financial plight slow his spendthrift ways. Faithfully, almost obsessively, he kept recording every purchase and expenditure. But it was as if somehow he could never bring himself to add up the columns. At home, in his voluminous farm records, he never in his life added up the profit and loss for any year, and perhaps for the reason that there was almost never any profit. On principle, Jefferson abhorred cities and their teeming throngs, quite as much as he abhorred debt. The mobs of great cities were like cancerous sores, he had written in his book on Virginia, a state entirely without cities. Nonetheless, he showed no interest now to live as Franklin and Adams did in semi-rural retreat outside Paris, where the panoramic views over the Seine were more like what he was accustomed to at home, and where the rent was appreciably less. He would reside by choice in the heart of the city his entire time in France, openly delighting in so much that was not to be found in Virginia. He relished all that Paris offered in the way of luxurious shopping, architecture, painting, music, theater, the finest food, the best wine, and the most cultivated society in his experience. Never mind what he may have written about cities or the expenses he incurred. Paris booksellers soon found they had an American patron like no other. In the bookshops and stalls along the Seine were volumes in numbers and variety such as Jefferson had never seen, and his pleasure was boundless. To Madison, he would describe the surpassing pleasure of examining all the principal bookstores, turning over every book with my own hand, and putting by everything related to America, and indeed whatever was rare and valuable to every science. There were weeks when he was buying books every day. In his first month in Paris, he could not buy them fast enough, and ran up bills totaling nearly 800 francs. Nor was the book-buying spree to end. The grand total of books he acquired in France was about 2,000. But he also bought books by the boxful for Washington, Franklin, and James Madison. With the purchase of works of art, he was tentative at first, buying only two small laughing busts, as he recorded, then a plaster statue of Hercules, and two portraits that he itemized only as heads. Then, in a spasm of bidding at an estate auction, he bought five mostly religious paintings, including a large Herodias bearing the head of St. John, which, like some of the others, was a copy, in this case of a popular work by Guido Reni. Before he was finished, Jefferson would buy 63 paintings in France, as well as seven terracotta busts for 1,100 livres by the greatest sculptor of the day, Jean-Antoine Houdon, whom, at the request of the Virginia legislature, Jefferson also commissioned to do a life-size statue of George Washington. Devoted to chess, eager to try his skill with some of the expert players of Paris, Jefferson found his way to a chess club, but was so decisively beaten in several games that he never went back. Though he could read French well enough, Jefferson was never to speak the language with the fluency Adams attained. Further, he was considerably more disapproving of the outspokenness and apparent promiscuity of French women than ever Adams had been. While Adams, on first arriving in Paris, had reported to Abigail how much he admired the French women he met, for their accomplishments, education, their views on serious matters, Jefferson felt that the decadent state of government in France was owing in good part to the influence of such women. He had at once placed 12-year-old Patsy in the most fashionable and most expensive convent school in Paris, the Abbaye Royale de Pontmont on the left bank, where, to Protestant students, he was assured, no word was ever spoken of religion, but where, presumably, she would be safe from social influences he thought wholly unsuitable for her. She wore a crimson uniform and was soon speaking French better than her father, who visited her frequently, enjoying the walk over the Seine by the Pont Neuf. One morning in October, Jefferson, Adams, Abigail, John Quincy, and Nabby went together to the convent to see two young nuns take the veil in a ceremony that Nabby would describe in her diary as an affecting sight for all. "I could not refrain from tears. Everyone seemed affected." Jefferson's devotion to his daughter, his obvious pleasure in her company, and her equally obvious devotion to him, were to the Adamses greatly to his credit. "She is a sweet girl. Delicacy and sensibility are read in every feature," Nabby wrote of Patsy, "and her manners are in unison with all that is amiable and lovely. She is very young." Tall for her age and freckled, she was commonly said to resemble her father. With the onset of winter, Jefferson took ill again. He was confined to the house for 6 weeks. Sunshine was his great physician, he liked to say, and there was too little of it in Paris. Then, in the last week of January, came crushing news from Virginia. His 2-year-old daughter, Lucy, had died of whooping cough. Of 6 children, now only 2 remained alive. The shadow of his unspeakable sorrow fell on everyone around him. The whole Adams household was in mourning. Jefferson, as so often in his life, retreated into silence and went on with his work. Section 4. To the diplomatic tasks at hand, Franklin, Adams, and Jefferson, the old revolutionary trio, gave due attention, working steadily and in easy accord. "We proceed with wonderful harmony, in good humor and unanimity," acknowledged Adams, whose sole complaint was a gnawing feeling of inutility. The issues before them were commercial treaties with the nations of Europe. But it was extremely slow, unexciting work, and with no notable progress. The new independent United States faced commercial barriers everywhere, while desperately in need of markets for American surpluses. The American position was free trade, but very little interest was shown. With Franklin confined to his quarters at Passy, most of the commissioners' working sessions were held there. They carried on correspondence, drew up reports, and, as obliged, appeared each Tuesday at the King's levee at Versailles, where afterward they dined with the Comte de Vergennes and the rest of the diplomatic corps. "It is curious to see 40 or 50 ambassadors, ministers, or other strangers of the first fashion from all the nations of Europe assembling in the most amicable manner and conversing in the same language," wrote Jefferson's aide, Colonel Humphreys. "What heightens the pleasure is their being universally men of unaffected manners and good dispositions." The 3 American commissioners tried not to get discouraged. But as Jefferson observed, "there is a want of confidence in us." Ultimately, for all their efforts, only 1 commercial treaty would be negotiated, that with Prussia. Writing to a correspondent at home, Adams said philosophically, "Public life is like a long journey, in which we have immense tracts of waste countries to pass through for a very few grand and beautiful prospects. At present, I scarcely see a possibility of doing anything for the public worth the expense of maintaining me in Europe." An equitable trade agreement with Britain was much the most important and pressing objective. But British-American relations had been strained since the Paris Peace Treaty, and the British remained maddeningly obdurate until that winter, when the commissioners were informed that His Majesty's government would welcome an American minister to reside constantly at the Court of St. James's. It seemed a hopeful shift in tide, but as such a matter could be decided only by Congress, the inevitable wait began. In letters to Congress stressing the need for an envoy to Britain, Adams neither offered recommendations nor said anything of his own feelings as ardently as he wanted the assignment. To Abigail, there was no question that he would be chosen. It was his destiny, she told Mary Cranch, and she was equally unambiguous about Jefferson's fitness for his role in France. Jefferson, she assured Cotton Tufts, was an excellent man and will do honor to his country. In marked contrast to both Franklin and Jefferson, Adams remained the picture of health. He had rarely ever looked or felt better. And indeed, life for the Adams family had settled into a routine which, if unspectacular, seemed to agree with all of them. Together, almost constantly, they enjoyed a contentment such as they had seldom known. Their days began early. With breakfast finished, weather permitting, John and John Quincy customarily set off for a 5 or 6 mile walk in the Bois de Boulogne before getting down to work. At 2 in the afternoon, the family gathered for dinner. Most afternoons, Adams was at Passy with Franklin and Jefferson. Tea was usually at 5, by which time it was dark. In the evenings, the family convened in the second-floor sitting room to read or play cards, except for John Quincy, who was at his studies again, it having been agreed that he would return home soon to enter Harvard. Many nights, Adams worked with him, happily playing the schoolmaster again and with his star pupil. At 17, the boy was extraordinarily accomplished. In his 7 years away from home and from conventional schooling, he had benefited immeasurably from his father's interest and encouragement. His travels, his reading, the time spent in the company of men like Francis Dana and Thomas Jefferson had given him a maturity, made him conversant on a breadth of subjects that people found astonishing. He had already seen more of Europe and Russia than any American of his generation. His French was virtually perfect. He was broadly read in English and Roman history. "If you were to examine him in English and French poetry, I know not where you would find anybody his superior," wrote Adams proudly to the boy's former tutor and guardian at Leiden, Dr. Benjamin Waterhouse. "He has translated Virgil's Aeneid, the whole of Sallust and Tacitus's Agricola, a great part of Horace, some of Ovid, and some of Caesar's commentaries, besides Tully's, Cicero's, orations. In Greek, his progress has not been equal, yet he has studied morsels of Aristotle's Politics in Plutarch's Lives and Lucian's Dialogues, the choice of Hercules in Xenophon, and lately he has gone through several books in Homer's Iliad. In mathematics, I hope he will pass muster. In the course of the last year, I have spent my evenings with him. We went with some accuracy through the Geometry and the Preceptor, the 8 books of Simpson's Euclid in Latin. We went through plane geometry, algebra, and the decimal fractions, arithmetical and geometrical proportions. I then attempted a sublime flight and endeavored to give him some idea of the differential method of calculations, and Sir Isaac Newton. But alas, it is 30 years since I thought of mathematics." The picture of father and son, heads together at a table, absorbed in their work, brought Abigail satisfaction of a kind she had been long denied. The table is covered with mathematical instruments and books, and you hear nothing till 9 o'clock but of theorem and problems, bisecting and dissecting, tangents and sequence, she recorded one evening at Otai, after which we are often called upon to relieve their brains by a game of whist. By Nabby's account, Papa's hour for bed was 10 o'clock, after which she and John Quincy would have a little conversation among themselves. "We see but little company and visit much less," wrote Nabby, who found Otai less sociable than she desired. Still in a quandary over Royal Tyler, she had had almost no word from him, and while John Quincy's plans seemed neatly resolved, hers were not. No one liked the thought of John Quincy leaving. "I feel very loath to part with my son and shall miss him more than I can express," Abigail wrote to her sister Mary. But Master John was now also a man in most respects, all I may say but age, and it was his wish to go home. She herself felt waves of extreme homesickness. A heavy snow falling over Paris filled her with emotion because it looked so American. "What a sad misfortune it is to have the body in one place and the soul in another," she told Mary. The time in France had made her love her own country more than ever. And from the little experience she had had making the adjustment to foreign ways and foreign speech, from what she knew now that she had not before of the intricacies and difficulties of diplomacy, she wondered how in the world Mr. Adams had ever lived through the perplexing scenes he has had to encounter. Her regard for her country and for her husband had never been greater. But of all that Abigail wrote of life en famille in the house at Otai, perhaps the most memorable vignette was in a letter to her niece Lucy Cranch, dated January 5, 1785. Describing a festive scene at the dinner table, she managed to capture much that was essential about each of them, including herself, but of her Mr. Adams in particular. "You must know that the religion of this country requires an abundance of feasting and fasting, and each person has his particular saint, as well as each calling and occupation. Tomorrow is to be celebrated Le Jour des Rois. The day before this feast, it is customary to make a large paste pie into which one bean is put. Each person cuts his slice, and the one who is so lucky as to obtain the bean is dubbed king or queen. Accordingly, today, when I went in to dinner, I found one upon our table. Your cousin Nabby began by taking the first slice. But, alas, poor girl, no bean and no queen. In the next place, your cousin John seconded her by taking a larger cut, and, as cautious as Cousin T when he inspects merchandise, bisected his paste with mathematical circumspection. But to him it pertained not. By this time I was ready for my part, but first I declared that I had no cravings for royalty. I accordingly separated my piece with much firmness, nowise disappointed that it fell not to me. Your uncle, who was all this time picking his chicken bone, saw us divert ourselves without saying anything, but presently he seized the remaining half. And to crumbs went the poor paste, cut here and slash there, when behold the bean. And thus, said he, are kingdoms obtained. But the servant who stood by and saw the havoc declared solemnly that he could not retain the title, as the laws decreed it to chance and not to force. When during that spring of 1785 Queen Marie Antoinette gave birth to a son, the Duke of Normandy, a Te Deum was sung in thanks at Notre Dame, with the king himself taking part. As intended, it was one of the grandest occasions of the reign of Louis XVI and his queen. And the four Adamses and Thomas Jefferson, along with everyone of fashion in Paris, were in attendance. Of the spectacles the Americans beheld in Paris, this was surpassing, and would be recalled for years afterward, when such memories of France had become part of a vanished world. The crowds en route to the cathedral were greater than any they had ever seen in their lives. Jefferson speculated to Nabby that there were as many people in the streets as in all of Massachusetts. "There was but just space sufficient for the carriages to pass along," wrote John Quincy. "And had there not been guards placed on both sides at a distance not greater than 10 yards from one another, there would have been no passage at all for the coaches. For as it was, the troops had the utmost difficulty to restrain the mob." Thanks to Madame Lafayette, they were seated in a gallery overlooking the choir. "As good a place as any in the church," thought John Quincy, who, in a long description of the spectacle in his diary, demonstrated that, besides being precociously erudite, he had learned, as his father urged, to observe the world around him, and was well started on becoming an accomplished writer. He described the Parliament lined up to the right side of the choir, robed in scarlet and black, the Chambre des Comptes on the left, in robes of black and white, the bishops arriving two by two, a purple kind of mantle over their shoulders, the Archbishop of Paris, a mitre upon his head, and finally the arrival of the king. And as soon as His Majesty had got to his place and fallen upon his knees, they began to sing the Te Deum, which lasted half an hour, and in which we heard some exceeding fine music. What a charming sight! An absolute king of one of the most powerful empires on earth, and perhaps a thousand of the first personages of that empire, adoring the divinity who created them, and acknowledging that he can in a moment reduce them to the dust from which they spring. Another day he wrote of the show of fashion and wealth at Longchamp in the Bois de Boulogne during the week before Easter. "There are, perhaps, each of these days, 1,000 carriages that come out of Paris to go round and round one of the roads in the wood one after another. There are 2 rows of carriages. One goes up and the other down, so that the people in every carriage can see all the others. Everybody that has got a splendid carriage, a fine set of horses, or an elegant mistress, send them out on these days to make a show at Longchamp." After so many years of living and traveling in Europe, the prospect of returning to the pale of college was more than a little discouraging to the boy. But, like his father, he was determined that as long as I shall be able to get my own living in an honorable manner, I will depend on no one. "My father has been so much taken up all his lifetime with the interests of the public that his own fortune has suffered by it, so that his children will have to provide for themselves, which I will never be able to do if I loiter away my precious time in Europe." With the return of fair weather in April, life picked up. Jefferson, his health recovered, became notably sociable and by choice spent part of nearly every day with some or all of the Adamses. For all that would be said later of Jefferson's love of the French and regard for the philosophes, he clearly preferred to be with the Adamses whenever possible. His pleasure in Abigail's company was overflowing and delighted her, while Franklin, as she wrote, was vastly social and civil. She loved the feeling of being included at the center of things, in much the way she had felt while dining on board the French warships in Boston Harbor. On the evening of April 26th, Jefferson rode out from Paris to deliver a letter that had just arrived from Elbridge Gerry, informing Adams that he had been named minister to the court of St. James's. It was requested that he be in London no later than the king's birthday, on June 4th. Within days, Jefferson learned that he was indeed to replace Franklin as minister to France. And it was with considerable sadness that Jefferson and the Adamses realized the end was at hand to a time like none other they had known. Nobody said goodbye to Paris without some sadness, Abigail was told. Gone from her writing were accounts of the dirt and dissipations of the French. Instead, she regretted leaving for the harsher climate of London, regretted leaving her garden, regretted especially the loss of Jefferson's society. John Adams, too, for all his ambition to serve in London, seemed anything but eager to leave the setting of such sustained contentment. "I shall find nowhere so fine a little hill, so pleasant a garden, so noble a forest, and such pure air and tranquil walks as at Otaï," he wrote to Richard Cranch. "I shall part with Mr. Jefferson with great regret." Adams took his new assignment with utmost seriousness, rightly confident that he had given as much thought to British-American relations and issues of war and peace as had any American. What friendly and decent terms could be achieved in the next few years would be crucial for both nations. Concerned about protocol in London, worried how he might be received, dreading the thought of people staring at him, he turned for advice to the British ambassador to France, the Duke of Dorset, whom he liked and trusted. In his diary afterward, Adams recorded the essence of the conversation. "He said that Lord Carmarthen was their Minister of Foreign Affairs, that I must first wait on him, and he would introduce me to His Majesty. I asked Lord Carmarthen's age. He said 33. He said I should be stared at a great deal. I told him I trembled at the thought of going there. I was afraid they would gaze with evil eyes." When another diplomat, assuming that Adams welcomed the change in assignment, remarked that no doubt Adams had a number of relatives in England, Adams took offense. "No," he declared, "he had no relatives there. I have not one drop of blood in my veins but what is American." Writing to Mercy Warren earlier, Adams had said emphatically that he was no John Bull, he was John Yankee. "And such shall I live and die." At Versailles, in parting conversation with the Comte de Vergennes, Adams listened as Vergennes grandly told him that it was, of course, a step down to go from the court of France to any other court, even if a great thing to be the first ambassador from your country to the country you sprang from. When Jefferson called on the aging foreign minister, he demonstrated perfectly why he would be so welcome at the French court. "You replace Mr. Franklin, I hear," said Vergennes. "I succeed," said Jefferson. "No one can replace him." What passed between Adams and Franklin at their final parting was not recorded. Doubtless, both were perfectly cordial. There would be further work to transact between them, further correspondence to maintain. But it was the last time they were ever to see one another. At the house at Otaï, everyone began packing. In the second week of May, John Quincy set off for Lorient, on the first leg of the long journey home to America. He would sail on a French packet, and as part of his passage was to look after a gift from Lafayette to George Washington of 7 hunting dogs. The final departure of John, Abigail, and Nabby from the house at Otaï, the afternoon of May 20th, 1785, was wrenching for everyone present. The servants, whom Abigail had once found such a trial, clustered about the carriage in tears. When she requested that her songbird be put inside the carriage with her, it fluttered so frantically in its cage that she had to give it up to her chambermaid. And it was on that melancholy note the family departed for Calais. "We journeyed slowly and sometimes silently," Abigail wrote to Jefferson. John passed the time en route to the Channel, reading the book Jefferson had presented as a parting gift, his own Notes on the State of Virginia, one of 200 copies he had had privately printed in Paris. The book, Adams would write to Jefferson, was Our Meditation All the Day Long, implying that he had been reading it aloud to Abigail and Nabby as they rolled toward Calais. The passages on slavery, said Adams, were worth diamonds. Alone at his desk at Poplar Forest, where more than 100 slaves labored in the fields beyond his window, Jefferson had written one of the most impassioned denunciations of his life, decrying slavery as an extreme depravity. The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, Jefferson had written, the most unremitting despotism on the one part and degrading submissions on the other. Our children see this and learn to imitate it. The parent storms, the child looks on, catches the lineaments of wrath, puts on the same airs in the circle of smaller slaves, gives a loose to his worst passions, and thus nursed, educated, and daily exercised in tyranny, cannot but be stamped by it with odious peculiarities. The man must be a prodigy who can retain his manners and morals undepraved by such circumstances. If a slave can have a country in this world, it must be any other in preference to that in which he is to be born to live and labor for another, or entail his own miserable condition on the endless generations proceeding from him. Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever. Continuing, Jefferson offered as a suspicion only that blacks were inferior to whites in both mind and body. Their inferiority, he wrote, is not the effect merely of their condition of life. It is not their condition, but nature which has produced the distinction. Besides their differences in color and hair, he noted, black people secreted less by the kidneys and more by the glands of the skin, which gives them a very strong and disagreeable odor. They were more tolerant of heat and less so of cold than whites, more ardent after their female, but love seemed with them to be more an eager desire than a tender, delicate mixture of sentiment and sensation. Their griefs are transient. Their existence appears to participate more of sensation than reflection. What John and Abigail Adams may have thought of this from the man who had professed to believe that all men are created equal is not known. The departure of your family has left me in the dumps, Jefferson wrote to Adams from Paris. My afternoons hang heavily on me. Crossing the channel on board the Dover packet days later, Abigail offered to share the family's cabin with a desperately seasick young man who, in gratitude for her kindness, gave her 2 songbirds of his own. As they were quite accustomed to traveling, I brought them here in safety, for which they happily repay me by their melodious notes, she would write to Jefferson in her first letter from London, knowing his love of music. Chapter 7. London. An ambassador from America. Good heavens, what a sound! London Public Advertiser. Section 1. His Majesty the King of England and the new American minister to the Court of St. James's were not without common interests and notable similarities. Like John Adams, King George III was devoted to farming. Seldom was His Majesty happier than when inspecting his farms or talking crops and merino sheep with his farm workers at Windsor. Like Adams, the king had a passion for books. The difference, as with the farming, was mainly a matter of scale. His private library was one of the treasures of Britain. During Adams's earlier stay in London, the American painter Benjamin West had arranged a tour of the royal quarters at Buckingham House, and for Adams the high point had been seeing the King's Library. He wished he could stay a week, Adams had said. George III was to turn 47 on June the 4th, which made him 2 years younger than Adams, and, though taller, he had a comparable inclination to corpulence. Like Adams, he was an early riser, often out of bed before 5. He, too, kept to a rigorous schedule and was an exuberant talker. Adams would later say George III was the greatest talker he had ever known. He was obstinate, affectionate, devoted to his wife and children, who numbered 15. Again, it was a matter of scale. He was deeply religious and, like Adams, sincerely patriotic. Yet, for all they had in common, the principal difference between the two was vast and paramount. One was the King of England, the other a Yankee farmer's son, John Yankee, who spoke now for an upstart nation the survival of which was anything but assured. Indeed, in England, as in Europe, it was generally thought that the experiment in democracy across the water had little chance of success. With his appointment to the court, Adams felt he had attained the pinnacle of his career. And with the retirement of Franklin, he was now America's most experienced diplomat. But from Elbridge Gerry he had learned that the appointment had come only after rancorous dispute in Congress, and that the central issue, as Gerry reported with blunt candor, was Adams's vanity, his weak passion. Gerry's letter had arrived in the last days at Otay. Deeply hurt, Adams had written an extraordinary reply. A dissertation on the subject of vanity set forth in his clearest, plainest hand, as if intended for posterity as much as for Gerry. There were all kinds of vanity, Adams wrote, of material possessions, of physical appearance, of ribbons and titles. But there was also that which came from years spent in the service of other men without attention to oneself in the face of exhausting toil and at risk of life. This latter kind was a vanity, a pride, he knew. He had experienced that joy, and for him to deny it or try to conceal it would be rank hypocrisy. If at times I have betrayed in word or writing such a sentiment, I have only to say in excuse for it that I am not a hypocrite, nor a cunning man, nor at all times wise, and that although I may be more cautious for the future, I will never be so merely to obtain the reputation of a cunning politician, a character I neither admire nor esteem. Apologizing for the length of the letter, Adams added finally in a small hand at the bottom of the page, "When a man is hurt, he loves to talk of his wounds." But after further thought, and possibly on the advice of Abigail, he put the letter aside. It was never sent. The old charge of vanity, the character flaw that Adams so often chastised himself for, had been made again, and on the floor of Congress, just as he was bound to assume his most important role. So now, more than ever, he felt bound to do all in his power to serve honorably, succumbing neither to vanity nor political craftiness. On arrival in London, he went promptly as instructed to confer with young Lord Carmarthen. Informed that his private audience with the King was arranged for June 1st, he began preparing himself for what he knew would be an occasion of historic importance for his country and one of the great events of his life. Told that he must deliver a brief speech before the King, and that it be as complimentary as possible, he worked and reworked what he would say until he knew it by heart. Of the times when Adams felt himself uncomfortably alone at center stage, there were few to compare to the afternoon in London when at the end of a short ride through the rain with Lord Carmarthen in his carriage, they approached the arched gatehouse at St. James's Palace. Doors opened for them. Adams was led up a flight of stairs and down a hall to a room crowded with ministers of state, lords, bishops, and courtiers, all eyes on him as he and Carmarthen stood waiting outside the king's bedchamber, which was not where the king slept, but a formal reception room. When the door opened, they proceeded, Adams, as instructed, making three bows or reverences, one on entering, another halfway, a third before the presence. "The United States of America have appointed me their minister plenipotentiary to your majesty," Adams began, nearly overcome by emotion. "I felt more than I did or could express," he later wrote. Before him, in the flesh, was the tyrant who, in the language of the Declaration of Independence, had plundered American seas and burned American towns. The monarch, unfit to be the ruler of a free people, while to the king he himself, Adams knew, could only be a despised traitor fit for the hangman's noose. "The appointment of a minister from the United States to your majesty's court will form an epoch in the history of England and of America," he continued. "I think myself more fortunate than all my fellow citizens in having the distinguished honor to be the first to stand in your majesty's royal presence in a diplomatic character. And I shall esteem myself the happiest of men if I can be instrumental in recommending my country more and more to your majesty's royal benevolence, and of restoring an entire esteem, confidence, and affection, or, in better words, the old good nature and the old good humor between people who, though separated by an ocean and under different governments, have the same language, a similar religion, and kindred blood. I beg your majesty's permission to add that, although I have some time before been entrusted by my country, it was never in my whole life in a manner so agreeable to myself." Brief as it was, he got through the speech only with difficulty, his voice at times quaking, and the king, too, was greatly moved. "The king listened to every word I said, with dignity but with apparent emotion," Adams would report to Foreign Secretary John Jay. "Whether it was in the nature of the interview, or whether it was my visible agitation, for I felt more than I did or could express, that touched him, I cannot say. But he was much affected, and answered me with more tremor than I had spoken with." "The circumstances of this audience are so extraordinary, the language you have now held is so extremely proper, and the feelings you have discovered so justly adapted to the occasion, that I must say that I not only receive with pleasure the assurance of the friendly dispositions of the United States, but that I am very glad that the choice has fallen upon you to be their minister. I wish you, sir, to believe, and that it be understood in America, that I have done nothing in the late contest but what I thought myself indispensably bound to do by the duty which I owed to my people. I will be very frank with you. I was the last to consent to separation. But the separation having been made, and having become inevitable, I have always said, as I say now, that I would be the first to meet the friendship of the United States as an independent power." He could not vouch that these were the exact words Adams cautioned in his letter to Jay, for the king's manner of speaking had been so odd and strained. It was Adams's first encounter with the famous stutter of George III. He hesitated some time between his periods and between the members of the same period. He was indeed much affected. Smiling, the king changed the subject. "There is an opinion among some people that you are not the most attached of all your countrymen to the manners of France," he said. Adams, embarrassed, replied, "I must avow to your majesty I have no attachment but to my own country." "An honest man will never have any other," the king said approvingly, and with a bow signaled that the interview was ended. "I retreated," Adams wrote, "stepping backwards, as is the etiquette, and making my last reverence at the door of the chamber, I went my way. The master of ceremonies joined me, and accompanied me through the apartments down to my carriage, several stages of servants, gentlemen porters, and under-porters, roaring out like thunder as I went along, 'Mr. Adams's servants! Mr. Adams's carriage!'" It had all gone superbly. Adams's remarks had been graceful, dignified, appropriate, and with the possible exception of his reference to kindred blood, altogether sincere. He had proven a diplomat of first rank, almost in spite of himself. The king, too, had been the essence of courtesy and poise, as Adams later acknowledged. But any thought that the interview presaged an overall cordial welcome for the new minister was dashed soon enough by the London press, which dismissed the meeting as nothing more than a curious anecdote for future historians. "An ambassador from America! Good heavens, what a sound!" scoffed the public advertiser. The London Gazette expressed rank indignation at the very appointment of such a character as Adams to the court. To the Daily Universal Register, it had been a notably cool reception, while the Morning and Daily Advertiser described Adams as so pitifully embarrassed as to be tongue-tied. Beneath the polite English surface lay burning animosity, surmised Abigail, who, like John, felt she was taking part in an elaborate stage play. Until a suitable house could be found, the three Adamses were residing in the Bath Hotel in Piccadilly, where, after the quiet of Otaï, the noise of the streets seemed horrendous. Abigail hated the thought of having to hire servants again, and making the necessary domestic arrangements on her own. "I cannot bear to trouble Mr. Adams with anything of a domestic kind, who from morning until evening has sufficient to occupy all his time," she wrote to her sister Mary. Still, she delighted in being once more where her own language was spoken. A performance of Handel's Messiah at Westminster Abbey was sublime beyond description, she wrote to Jefferson. "I most sincerely wished for your presence, as your favorite passion would have received the highest gratification. I should have sometimes fancied myself amongst the higher order of beings." 3 weeks after Adams's private audience with the king came the Queen's Circle, or Drawing Room. This time, all three of the family were to attend, as well as Colonel William Stephen Smith of New York, who had been appointed by Congress as Secretary of the American Legation and was also newly arrived in London. Smith had served with distinction in the Continental Army. At the Battle of Long Island, he had made the night withdrawal across the East River, and later served on Washington's staff. He was a graduate of the college at Princeton, and with his soldierly carriage and dark good looks, made a handsome addition to the group. Days were consumed in preparation. "She must look elegant but plain as I could possibly appear with decency," Abigail instructed her dressmaker. The dress she wore was of white silk, trimmed with white crepe and lilac ribbon, over an enormous hoop. A very dress cap with long lace lappets, two white plumes, and a blonde lace handkerchief. "This is my rigging," she informed Mary in high spirits. "I should have mentioned two pearl pins in my hair, earrings, and necklace of the same kind." Nabby's attire, too, was in white, only with a petticoat, the most showy part, and included a cap with three immense feathers. Mother and daughter had seldom, if ever, looked so glorious. "Thus equipped, we go in our own carriage," wrote Abigail. "But I must quit my pen to put myself in order for the ceremony which begins at 2 o'clock." "Congratulate me, my dear sister. It is over," she commenced the next installment, settling in to describe in detail and with wry humor all that had transpired, and leaving little doubt as to what she thought of such business overall, or whether she was capable of meeting the test, even if it meant 4 hours on her feet. Of the English novelists, Abigail was especially fond of Samuel Richardson, whose popular works, Pamela and Clarissa, were tales told through the device of extended letters. Richardson, master of the human heart, had done more towards embellishing the present age and teaching them the talent of letter-writing than any other modern I can name. That her own outpouring of letters was influenced by Richardson, Abigail would have readily agreed. In Richardson's hands, events unfolded in letters written to the moment, as things happened. "My letters to you," she would tell Mary, "are first thoughts, without correction." At the palace, the Adamses were escorted to a large drawing room, where 200 selected guests, including foreign diplomats and their wives, were arranged in a large circle. The king enters the room and goes round to the right, the queen and princesses to the left. Abigail began her account for Mary. "Only think of the task the royal family have, to go round to every person and find small talk enough to speak to all of them. Though they very prudently speak in a whisper, so that only the person who stands next can hear what is said. The lord-in-waiting presents you to the king, and the lady-in-waiting does the same to her majesty. The king is a personable man, but, my dear sister, he has a certain countenance which you and I have often remarked, a red face and white eyebrows. When he came to me, Lord Onslow," Arthur Onslow, Lord of the Royal Bedchamber, "said, 'Mrs. Adams,' upon which I drew off my right glove, and His Majesty saluted my left cheek, then asked me if I had taken a walk today. I could have told His Majesty that I had been all morning preparing to wait upon him, but I replied, 'No, sire.' 'Why don't you love walking?' says he. I answered that I was rather indolent in that respect. He then bowed and passed on. It was more than 2 hours after this before it came my turn to be presented to the queen. The circle was so large that the company were 4 hours standing. The queen was evidently embarrassed when I was presented to her. I had disagreeable feelings, too. She, however, said, 'Mrs. Adams, have you got your house? Pray, how do you like the situation of it?' Whilst the Princess Royal, Charlotte Augusta Matilda, the oldest daughter of George III and Queen Charlotte, looked compassionate and asked me if I was much fatigued, and observed that it was a very full drawing room. Her sister, who came next, Princess Augusta, after having asked your niece if she was ever in England before, and her answering yes, inquired me how long ago, and supposed it was when she was very young. And all this is said with much affability and ease and freedom of old acquaintance." The two princesses were quite pretty, well-shaped, heads full of diamonds. Queen Charlotte, however, was neither pretty nor well-shaped, and on the whole, Abigail told Mary, the ladies of the court were very plain, ill-shaped, and ugly. But don't tell anybody that I say so. All things considered, the royal family was surprisingly affable. But certainly the life they led was not to be envied. Nor should anyone imagine that Abigail remained anything other than herself. I could not help reflecting with myself during the ceremony, what a fool I do look like to be thus accoutred and stand for 4 hours together only to be spoken to by royalty. The suitable house was found, and their furniture having arrived from France, the family moved to the quiet of Grosvenor Square in the West End. The tree-shaded square, with its neat gravel walks, covered 5 acres, exactly the size of the garden at Otaï, and was framed by elegant townhouses belonging to a number of London's most eminent citizens, including Lord Carmarthen. The house the Adamses rented, what became the first American legation in London, was number 8, at the northeast corner. The front entrance opened onto a large hall. There was a dining room spacious enough for entertaining on the first floor, and another ample room that Adams made his office for public business. Drawing room and library were on the floor above, bedrooms on the third floor. The kitchen was in the English basement, and a stable was to the rear. Once the servants were hired and in place below stairs, the staff consisted of Esther Field, now elevated to lady's maid, a butler, a housemaid, a cook, a kitchen maid, 2 footmen, one of whom was John Breesler, and a coachman. This made a total of 8, as at Otaye. And again, Abigail would have preferred fewer who worked harder. Adams, after several weeks in residence, allowed that after so long in France, he was not so pleased with English cookery. But these were quibbles. The house suited perfectly. For Adams, the location was ideal. Abigail had a small room of her own with a view of the square, a place to write and be alone with her thoughts, and to Nabby, it was all a decided improvement over Otaye. "We shall live more as if we were part of the world," she wrote to John Quincy. That world, London of the 1780s, was a city grown all out of proportion, with nearly 1 million souls. Though a city still of smoke and damp, in Adams's words, it was an appreciably cleaner, healthier, less violent place than it had been earlier in the century. It was both the political capital of Britain and the center of manufacturing, finance, and trade. The Thames, its foul, mud-colored main artery and portal to the world, carried more traffic than any river in Europe. One had only to stand on any London bridge, said a guidebook, to see fleets of ships carrying away the manufactures of Britain and bringing back the produce of the whole earth, a spectacle illustrating Adams's chief concern as ambassador, since none was American. The great dome of St. Paul's Cathedral rose high above what seemed a forest of towers, turrets, and church spires, very unlike the skyline of Paris. 1,000 hackneys plied the streets, and innumerable sedan chairs, each propelled by 4 strong men, usually Irish, who could shout and muscle their way through traffic faster than the hackneys. All was tumult and hurry, just as portrayed in English novels. Bond Street shops were thought superior to those of Paris. London coffee houses, taverns, theaters, and concert halls surpassed anything of the kind elsewhere in the British Empire. And for the young and aspiring, London remained the great magnet. Exhilaration of the kind voiced by young James Boswell of Edinburgh upon seeing the city for the first time in 1762 was felt still by thousands who kept coming from the hinterlands. In London was to be found the full tide of human existence, Boswell's hero Samuel Johnson had said, declaring famously, "When a man is tired of London, he is tired of life." The extravagance of the ruling class was notorious. At such exclusive clubs as Brooks or Boodle's on St. James's Street, fortunes were reputedly gambled away at the turn of a card. And nightly, young men drank themselves into a stupor. This was not quite true, but the stories would never die, and the clothes, carriages, and sheer weight of gold braid on the livery of servants left little doubt as to how vast was the wealth of the wealthiest. Yet, as the Adamses found, one could hardly go anywhere without encountering such spectacles of poverty and misery as to tear at the heart. People in tatters, hunger and suffering in their faces, as Abigail wrote. And who was to answer for the wretched victims who are weekly sacrificed upon the gallows in numbers sufficient to astonish a civilized people. Compounding her sorrow was the realization that every night and in all weather, abandoned children by the hundreds slept beneath the bushes and trees of nearby Hyde Park. The English historian and novelist, Tobias Smollett, had written of the inevitable distrust felt by every visitor to London, the underlying fear of being taken. For his part, Adams was determined to be neither stingy nor a fool. Approached by the representative of a group known as His Majesty's Royal Bell Ringers, who asked that he share some of his honorable bounty and said 2 guineas were customary, Adams gave the man 1 guinea and said he would look into what was customary. James Boswell could still be seen on occasion holding forth at the Globe Tavern on Fleet Street. The novelist Fanny Burney was soon to become a lady-in-waiting to Queen Charlotte. Richard Brinsley Sheridan was still part owner and manager of the famous Drury Lane Theatre. But the giants of London's literary world, authors to whom the Adamses were devoted, Richardson, Sterne, Smollett, Samuel Johnson, were all dead and gone. And so, too, was Hogarth. The reigning artists were the rivals Thomas Gainsborough and Joshua Reynolds, and the American Benjamin West, who did elegant portraits and historical scenes rather than graphic renditions of the dark side of London life.